It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Filmmakers from around the country and around the world are coming to Madison next month for the annual Wisconsin Film Festival. This year's festivities include 150 films showed in 7 different venues across 8 straight days. The movies come in all different lengths, formats, and genres. If you're going, how do you choose what to see? Our next guest is here to help us make any film festival experience more approachable and preview what's in store this year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been to a film festival, this film festival in particular, or maybe something in your neck of the woods? What did you like or dislike about it? Were you overwhelmed with choices? Are you a filmmaker? Do you show things at festivals? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike King is the artistic director for the Wisconsin Film Festival. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
I've seen you elsewhere describe this film festival as omnivorous. You do a lot of variety at this thing. Can you talk about the scope of films that you are looking for at the film festival?
Yes, absolutely. We show all different kinds of movies, feature films, short films. You know, a bunch of the 150 films that are in the festival are short films, but we have lots and lots of features, films from all over the planet and all over America and all over Wisconsin. So it's really a huge variety of movies, not only across the planet, but across time. We show films all the way back to the silent era with live accompaniment on piano, right up to movies that just premiering haven't even premiered yet in South by Southwest that's happening right now. So it covers the whole spectrum of cinema. We also have an entire slate devoted to films for the whole family. So children's films, lots of great programming in there as well. So it's really everything you could imagine.
Yeah, one question leaps to mind. You know, sometimes I can't decide which breakfast cereal to eat today. You're picking 150 films out of all the movies around the world ever. Like, how do you get started on planning a program like that?
Absolutely. Well, I work with Jim Healy, who's the director of programming at the UW Cinematheque, and he and I program the lion's share of the international and repertory selections. And then we have a team led by Ben Reiser, who does the Wisconsin Zone program, and another one by Terry Kerr, who does the children's programming. So it's not just me. Mm-hmm. But anyways, Jim and I attend the Toronto Film Festival every fall. That's in September. And that's kind of the North American launch pad for international cinema. So we go there for a full week and we see 5 movies a day. And then that's when we start making our wish list of the kinds of movies we'd like to bring to the festival. And we really program by our enthusiasms. So it's the stuff that we're excited about that we want to bring. Then we usually go to Sundance a few months later and see a whole new slate of movies. And in between those, we're watching Lynx all the time, nonstop, just constantly trying to find new and exciting movies that we can bring to the festival. As far as repertory selections, we are really have our eye on new restorations and exciting restorations. This year, we even are premiering a restoration, the North American premiere of this fantastic Japanese movie from 1993 called Moving, for instance, which I highly recommend. So we're trying to bring movies that are brand new restorations, and we bring in archivists as well to present them.
Now, are movies still fun for you, or does it feel like I'm watching 5 movies a day here? This is a lot of work.
Well, I got to say, you know, it is fun. You know, when you see a good one, it really lifts your spirits. You know, when I'm programming the festival, not everything I watch is good, certainly. So there, I do get in a rut here and there, but it's all worth it when we can assemble a program that is fun. But it's been a while since I've watched a movie recreationally.
Now, for someone who hasn't been to a film festival, you helped put this one on. You've been to a lot of them. Can you talk people through the basics? Like, how do they prep? How do they plan that itinerary? How do they pick from? Nobody's going to see, I think, all 150 films. How do you prioritize when you go see things?
Right. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people who go all in and they go every single day. And those are probably not the people who need their handheld in this instance. But you know, if this is your first time attending a film festival, I would suggest, you know, it can be overwhelming to just open it up and see all these movies, and it's a lot to comb through. So maybe just look at the grid, which is our timeline that explains when all the films are showing, and see what a time works for you. Like, maybe you think, I want to see a movie Friday night of the film festival. That will instantly narrow it down to maybe, you know, 5 or 6 selections in a different time slot. And then that can help you sort of guide through what your options are. That's how I approach. If I'm traveling to a film festival, I say, well, I'm going to be here these days. These are my choices. So that can instantly sort of narrow it down. Now, probably you'll go on Friday night and have such a good time that you'll cancel the rest of your plans that week and see movies for 7 more days. But
we're talking to Mike King, artistic director for the Wisconsin Film Festival. That's coming up in a couple weeks. Tickets on sale now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about this film festival, film festivals in general, if you have gone to film festivals, this one in particular, or shown films at festivals, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike, I want to get a taste of some of the movies. We can't get through all of them here. Let's start in Wisconsin. You are featuring some Wisconsin, mostly short films, I think, and some others. Give us a sense of what our neighbors are making.
Absolutely. Well, we have every year we award several movies for the Wisconsin Film Festival, which we call the Golden Badgers. And these are all the films that are submitted and selected for the Wisconsin Zone program. We bring in a jury who watches all of these movies ahead of time, and which they did a couple weeks ago at the UW Cinematheque, and they choose the three winners. So this year, those three winners are a movie called Patient, which is directed by Lori Felker, who's a fantastic filmmaker who we've featured many times over the festival. There's a movie called Parallel Botany, which is a beautiful experimental film. And there's a movie called February, which is a great narrative film about a Mexican immigrant in Wisconsin. So these are, you know, three totally different kinds of movies, not the kinds of things that you'll get to see the rest of the year. And that we're presenting them in the theater with the filmmakers in attendance. So they're all in different shorts programs. So if you want to see the Golden Badgers winners, that will take you to three different shorts programs right there. We're very excited to be showing the new film by Wendy Schneider called Angels of Dirt. She, of course, directed the Smart Studios story about the Madison Institution some years ago. This is a movie that she's been working on for many years that takes place at a Wisconsin racetrack.
Yeah, we talked to Wendy on the show actually a couple of few years ago when she was, I think, just kicking off that project. Now I want to journey to the exotic land of Canada. There's a movie I hadn't known about with Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall. There's a story behind this movie. It's a very rare opportunity to see The Wrong Guy, I think it's called.
The Wrong Guy. This is honestly a movie I've been trying to get to the film festival for a number of years. I learned a few years ago that there was a 35mm print of this in an archive in Toronto, and I've been bugging them, and finally I've lured it out of them. It is a very difficult movie to see. It never got a theatrical release in America. And it's not streaming. You can't find a disc very easily. It's a hilarious movie starring Dave Foley, made right when he was doing News Radio. It's a spoof of Man on the Run kind of thrillers, like Hitchcockian type things. Basically, the premise is Dave Foley has a breakdown at a board meeting in his corporate office and says he's going to kill his boss. And then somebody else kills his boss. And Dave Foley feels like he's implicated and goes on the run. But it turns out the cops solved the case. No one's looking for Dave Foley. And he's just kind of like going through all these crazy things to try and maintain his anonymity, be on the lam. And no one's actually tracking him down. It's a great, funny movie, and this will be a rare opportunity to see it not only on 35mm, but at all.
And that's a good point. Before we go to our callers, Mike, I think in the streaming era, we think all the stuff we want to see is accessible somewhere whenever we want it. There's tons of film out there that just isn't that easy to see.
Absolutely. And I can tell you, we are very diligent about this at the festival. And, you know, none of the new movies are streaming yet. We will be presenting all of these films. This is the only chance to see them. Often these movies don't get American distribution at all. And this might be your only chance to see it. Forget about streaming. But none of these movies will be streaming when the festival happens, as far as the new films. Mm-hmm. And it's same with plenty of the older ones. You know, you can't stream The Wrong Guy. You can't stream Moving, the Japanese film I mentioned earlier. So, yeah, it's really a special chance.
Let's go to our callers now. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to give a shout out to the Wisconsin Film Festival. They do such an amazing job programming. Super big fan. The whole festival, I think, is accessible, fun, educational, public service minded. My husband and I went to the Toronto Film Fest a while back, and we felt that was very industry focused. You know, people wanting to buy films, you know, sell films, make connections, and we just kind of felt like, wow, we're here at the Premiere Festival and want to see films, and just kind of felt like, oh, this is like a huge letdown. But love the Wisconsin Film Festival.
Louise, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, the audience focus as opposed to the industry focus.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that, Louise. I really appreciate hearing that. And it's true. No one at the Wisconsin Film Festival is coming here to sell their movie or to make industry connections. We are a very audience-focused festival. And that's one of the things that not only, you know, our audience, of course, loves, but the filmmakers who come here love. They're sort of off the pressure of trying to get, you know, mentioned in Variety or whatever. And they are so appreciative of how receptive and invested our audience is. So it's one of the things that we really are happy about with our festival, for sure.
Thanks for the call, Louise. We're previewing the upcoming Wisconsin Film Festival with Artistic Director Mike King. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've never been to a film festival before, what would it take to draw you in? If you have been to this or other film festivals, what drew you in there? What did you appreciate about it? Are you a big fan of films, especially ones that maybe you can't just pull up on streaming? There are lots of them. Do you have questions about the Wisconsin Film Festival? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Mike King, Artistic Director at the Wisconsin Film Festival. That is coming up. Tickets on sale now. He's with us today for a preview of the films that will be shown at the event and help guide us through the film festival experience. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your own film festival experiences or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jack?
So I'm thinking about a couple of things here. First of all, I think the Wisconsin Film Festival is a remarkable institution, and I've been pretty fortunate to go a couple of years now. One of the things that I was curious about is I saw that a bipartisan effort came about in the legislature a couple of weeks ago to establish a film office for Wisconsin, in part because I was curious about what kind of movies do they film in the state and how many and whatnot, and, of course, how many get shown at events like the Wisconsin Film Fest. And so my question kind of is, like, what impact does the Wisconsin Film Fest and other film festivals in our state have on the state's film economy overall, and how does it relate to, you know, things like tax incentives to bring Hollywood and other filmmakers, particularly into.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, first of all, film festivals, their impact on the Wisconsin economy and maybe the effort to get more films made here in Wisconsin. Do you have thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, you know, I mean, there certainly is an impact on the economy of the Wisconsin Film Festival because we, you know, sort of activate so many people coming to see the movies and bring people in from all across the state and across the country. And I've heard about that tax incentive film office that the caller is describing, and I think that'd be a great thing moving forward, for sure.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jack. Yeah, I know some communities, like I think of Vancouver in Canada, you know,
right,
Rumble in the Bronx with the mountains of Vancouver in the background. Would you want to see Wisconsin be more aggressive in trying to bring not just maybe local talent, but try to lure and join the arms race to lure bigger productions to the state?
I mean, yes, obviously that would be incredible, you know, for sure.
Thanks again for the call, Jack. Steve is with us now in Sheboygan. Steve, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I believe you said you get about 150 that you screen. How many films are do you have to go through before you pick out that amount?
That's a great question. There are, I would say, you know, for every movie that I select, you know, I've probably taken a look at 10, you know. I don't necessarily watch all of every single one, but we are watching lots of movies to whittle it down to the ones that we want to show. for the Wisconsin Zone section, those are also submitted. So there is a certain amount of submissions that we get every year, and then we pull from that. But yeah, we watch lots and lots of movies to narrow it down to the ones that we think we're excited about and we want to bring to Madison and we think make a nice cohesive program and work well together.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Yeah, and I understand that film festivals, there's always some balance between this part we want people to submit and we're going to call from that. This part we're going to, you know, go out and find ourselves. How do you set the ratio on that? How do you decide how much is submitted versus how much we're just seeking out?
Well, our festival is unusual in that we are mostly a curated festival. Mm-hmm. The only films that are submitted are the Wisconsin Zone movies. And those tend to be a pretty reliable, similar amount every single year. And we're able to put together, you know, maybe five or six really great shorts programs and a couple features every year out of the many submissions that we get. So the balance we've struck is pretty consistent over the years. We do show, you know, mostly new movies. And then I would say there's probably a quarter that's repertory, which is really high for most film festivals. A lot of festivals, I feel, will, you know, maybe fill that out with less good new movies. But we just show really great older titles to make everything, you know, a great experience.
Thanks again for that call. Let's name some more names of some of the older movies that you're excited about this year that maybe people have never had a chance to see here.
For sure. You know, one of the movies that I'm so excited about, another one that I've been wanting to do for years, is a movie called The Tingler. And this is a 1950s sort of corny horror movie starring Vincent Price, directed by William Castle. And the gimmick when this movie came out, and William Castle's movies always were about gimmicks. And this movie, he attached buzzers underneath the seats, and it would vibrate at this point in the movie when the monster, the Tingler, which attaches to your spine in the movie and buzzes you, would get loose in the theater. And there's a part when he's like, "The Tingler's loose in the theater, you know, scream for your lives." And we're actually doing it with what he called Percepto. So we will be installing buzzers under select seats in the Cinematheque.
Wow.
For that screen. We're showing it twice on Friday night. And if you sit in the wrong or the right spot, depending on your perspective, you will get buzzed at that specific moment and scream for your life.
Wow. And is there somebody actually running around as the monster in the theater at this point?
No, he's done that in a different movie. So maybe we'll do that another time. But yeah, that's one that I've been wanting to do for forever.
And then I see there are some more familiar movies there. I started reading a description of a movie. And it sounds like, I was like, wait, this sounds like Stephen King's Christine. It is Stephen King. I had looked at the title first.
Yeah, right. We are showing Stephen King's Christine. That's part of a program that we're really proud to be doing. Salute to Columbia Pictures on their 100th anniversary. There's Wisconsin-born woman named Rita Belda is one of their executives in charge of restoration, and she is coming to the festival and presenting 10 movies from Columbia Pictures, including The Tingler, including Christine, including silent movies by Frank Capra. We'll be presenting with live accompaniment. So that's part of our, you know, salute to Columbia Pictures.
We're talking to Mike King, artistic director for the Wisconsin Film Festival. Back to your calls now. Joan is with us in Hobart. Joan, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to be quick because I know your time is running out. I have been to hundreds, well, maybe tens of film festivals, and I've been to your film festival, but I would like to know exactly when it is because you keep saying in a couple of weeks, and I would like to know where is the best place to stay. Should I stay right in Madison or should I stay in the outskirts of Madison? I do not live there. I live in Hobart.
Joan, thanks for the call. I don't know if you have specific lodging recommendations. The event is taking place entirely in Madison. Talk us through some of the specs, Mike.
I would love to. So the festival begins April 4th with opening night presentation of the fantastic new movie Io Capitano by the great Italian filmmaker Matteo Garrone. This film was one of only five films that was nominated for the best international film this year at the Oscars. And this will have its only screening in Madison at the film festival on opening night. That'll be at the Barrymore on the Near East Side, and we'll be there throughout the entire festival, closing 1 week later on April 11th with Alexander Payne in person presenting a 20th anniversary screening of Sideways. over the course of the weekend, so April 5th, 6th, and 7th, we will be all over downtown and the UW campus. So if you're coming then, I would recommend staying more central. We'll have screenings at the Bartell Theater, which we haven't been at for a long time. We always are at the UW Cinematheque, the Chazen Museum of Art, and the Marquee Theater at Union South. And this year, for the first time, we're also building a screen at Music Hall, which is at the base of Bascom Hill. And then the weekdays, we'll still be at the Barrymore, but we're moving for the first time ever to Flick's Brewhouse, which is in Easttown Mall, and which is my preferred place to see, you know, new blockbusters. And so we'll be there Monday through Thursday. So if you're coming during the week, I would suggest maybe staying more on the east side.
Joan, thanks for calling in. Hope that helps. And Mike, just in our last minute, you've mentioned a couple of in-person appearances to go along with the movies, including Alexander Payne at Sideways. Any other in-person things that's a really unique opportunity that people can see at a film fest?
Absolutely. One that I'm really excited about is a filmmaker named Ena Senjarvic. She's a Bosnian-Dutch filmmaker who we're bringing in to present her new movie, Sweet Dreams, which was the Netherlands' submission for the Academy Awards this year, and it's a fantastic story of colonialism in the Indonesia. She'll also be presenting her first film, which is a great kind of road movie called Take Me Somewhere Nice. And she'll be presenting a repertory selection of her own, which is a 35mm print of a Japanese film from the 60s called Pitfall.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mike King is the artistic director for the Wisconsin Film Festival. He was with us today to preview the event and help us make the most out of going to film festivals. Tickets are on sale now for the event, which runs April 4th through April 11th in Madison. We'll get a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the Biden administration announced a plan to create a strike force on unfair and illegal pricing. Among other things, the strike force would attempt to tackle what they call junk fees, which are unavoidable or surprise charges that can inflate prices but add little or no value to the service or product. Here's President Biden talking about his administration's plan for these so-called junk fees at his State of the Union address last week.
My administration has proposed rules to make cable, travel, utilities, and online ticket sellers tell you the total price up front so there are no surprises. It matters. It matters.
A representative from a consumer watchdog group joins us now for a look at the ways that these fees can affect consumers and possible action to bring down those fees or require some kind of disclosure. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where have you run into unexpected charges on products or services that you pay for? Do you find it tough to compare prices when you can't see these hidden charges? Do you think they've become common in recent years, more common? If you work at a business that's accused of having junk fees, do you think you're getting a bad rap? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Ariel Nelson is a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. Ariel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your organization works on these issues. Can you give us a sense of the range of products and services that might have these junk fees?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that we're noticing is that they really have been across a wide range of industries, bank accounts, credit cards, rental agreements in housing and cars, and even in the context of jails and prisons.
What are some of the solutions you're looking for? Well, I know there are a few. Let's start with one in particular that we just heard there from President Biden, the idea of disclosure and transparency. What kind of things do you hope to see?
So I think that disclosure and transparency are really the first step in getting at some of these issues. One of the big problems that we're seeing is that people don't know that these fees are going to be charged. You set it up front where you're trying to look around at different options. Maybe when you're looking for a hotel room, and it's really hard to know what the actual price is going to be because of these fees. And so I do think that transparency is the first step. We don't want any surprises. We want to be able to know upfront what we're going to pay. We want to be able to plan and budget. And it actually, these fees have really hurt honest businesses who want to disclose their price upfront, but maybe they can't because they're at such a disadvantage if they do that. So we really, part of the goal here is to encourage competition. And the Biden administration is trying to tackle this issue in a variety of ways. I think the biggest one, and maybe one of the most high profile ones, is that the Federal Trade Commission has proposed a rule that would prohibit hidden and also misleading junk fees.
One of the most famous examples here that has been a subject in Congress as well is ticket prices for concerts, sporting events, or other. Largely the company Ticketmaster gets a lot of fingers pointed at it. I'll make up numbers here. You go to buy a $50 event ticket and you end up paying $70 after the fees and things like that. Can you talk about how that happens, why that happens under the current system, and what could change about it?
Sure. So, yeah, it happens because right now, it in most places, it is allowed to happen. Some states are starting to look at these practices as well as the federal government, but generally, it is potentially permissible. Even to put some numbers on the ticket example you just said, in its press release, the Biden administration said that customers subjected to hidden fees spend up to 21% more than those shown the true price up front. They're looking into, they're trying to quantify exactly what's happening to us. I think that it's really helpful that the administration is putting a name to these practices. We maybe have experienced this and it's a nasty surprise, but now they're saying, look at this practice across industries and let's tackle it at a systemic level. I want to point out that sometimes when we're looking to go to a concert, sometimes it might just be, oh no, this is way more expensive than I thought, and that's really a drag. But sometimes it really hurts people, especially lower income people, as they're trying to plan and budget for things like rent.
And let's talk about the rental industry. That's one that people might be less familiar with when it comes to hidden and unexpected fees. What's going on there?
So as many folks may know, because in fact, most Americans are renters, oftentimes when you're going to rent an apartment, you face fees, unavoidable fees when you're searching for housing, for example, in the form of application fees or fees to even hold an apartment. You might experience them throughout the duration of your lease, whether it's in the form of different kinds of processing or administrative or convenience fees, notice fees, valet trash fees, pest control fees, and then even at the end of your lease, like fees for cleaning or other sorts of move out fees. And the Biden administration, thanks to, a lot of talking about this issue by tenants and organizers and housing advocates, has now said, yes, these fees fall under this umbrella of junk fees. And they, as of right now, are included within the proposed rule by the FTC. They would be covered and they would have to be disclosed up front and they couldn't be misleading.
Arielle Nelson is with us from the National Consumer Law Center, looking at efforts by the Biden administration to crack down on unexpected fees, hidden fees on a wide variety of products and services, the administration calling them junk fees. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this yourself in your bank account, buying a ticket, in your rentals, going to a hotel? The list goes on and on. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the financial industry now. In his State of the Union address last week, President Biden addressed credit card late fees. Here's a little bit of that.
My administration announced we're cutting credit card late fees from $32 to $8. Banks and credit card companies are allowed to charge what it costs them to instigate the collection. And that's more, a hell of a lot, like $8 and 30-some dollars. They don't like it. The credit card companies don't like it. But I'm saving American families $20 billion a year with all the junk fees I'm eliminating.
Ariel, people might ask, can the administration just do that and say, hey, credit card companies, we're capping your late fee charges?
I mean, I would argue yes. I think that we may have already seen some challenges to that rule. Certainly there will be litigation over whatever rules the different agencies put out. But that doesn't mean that the agencies can't do it. It'll be a fight in the courts.
And how important is that in some cases confusion or disagreement about executive branch White House authority to regulate these kind of things? Do you see that as an obstacle to potentially a lot of these proposed solutions?
Potentially, but I think that it doesn't mean that it's not worth doing, especially because I think the legal authority is really strong. And, you know, I think this is the type of issue that folks should see as bipartisan or nonpartisan. We have all experienced different forms of these. And, you know, when we hear folks on the business side saying things like, well, we have to charge some of these fees, my main question is, well, if you have to charge them, how come they're hidden and how come it's just not included in the upfront price? Why isn't it part of the total price? So I think, to me, that's part of the issue that's going on here. Why don't you want to disclose them? Is it because you're trying to prevent competition? Is it because you're trying to profit a huge amount off of people? I think these should be the kinds of things that we can all agree on.
Yeah, one of the key arguments, I think, in favor of regulation is, you know, you might think that the market would help fix this. If company A has a reputation for charging these fees, then I'll go to company B, who doesn't. Why is it not playing out that way in reality?
I think part of it is again, the hidden aspect of it, where you get through often a process of purchasing something and you don't see the fee until later on. And you're so far down the road, you just go through with that purchase. And I think that companies have felt that to compete, everyone has to be doing this process. And so we really need these fixes to make sure that we can ensure competition. And that's certainly how the Biden administration is talking about it, is what they want to do is ensure that there is competition and that honest businesses have a fair shake at this.
We're talking to Ariel Nelson, staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center, talking about the Biden administration's effort to target what they call junk fees in a wide number of consumer industries. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this where you've bought something or done business with someone and fees start popping up that you didn't see reflected in the initial price that was advertised that you thought you'd pay? How did you feel about that? Do you feel like the federal government should be taking efforts to rein in hidden or unexpected fees? Do you have questions for our guest from a national consumer advocacy group? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ariel Nelson, staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. We're talking about so-called junk fees, those surprise charges on things like tickets, credit cards, rentals, the list goes on, and the Biden administration's efforts to eliminate them, scale them back, or require disclosure and transparency of these kind of charges. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into these kind of fees? Have you found them to be an inconvenience, or are they a matter of financial well-being? Are you frustrated with these things? Do you want to see some kind of government action? Do you work in a business that charges the fees we're talking about? Do you feel like they're getting unfairly portrayed? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ariel, I want to follow up on something you mentioned earlier. A part of this story that might be invisible to a lot of people, fees facing prison inmates, people in the justice system. What kind of things are going on?
Thanks for asking that question. This is definitely an area that might be hidden to a lot of people, but maybe not as many as we think, given just how many people in this country have been incarcerated and how many of those people have families who help support them while they're incarcerated. So what happens is that vendors in what we'll call the consumer correctional service industry impose these fees on justice-involved people and their families from the time someone's arrested through their incarceration and even after their release. And the places where these charges happen can include things like bail, and also a big one for folks is around money transfers. We envision correctional facilities as providing a basic level of subsistence to people who are incarcerated. But that's not always the case. And loved ones usually have to pick up the slack by sending money for basic necessities like hygiene products, food, over-the-counter medication. And the companies that handle these money transfers charge often really high and hidden fees. So those are just some of the examples of places where families are picking up the slack and are really suffering with respect to fees. But I will say that this is one area in which competition encouraged by a rule like one that would prohibit hidden fees won't be encouraged, because folks on the inside don't necessarily have the choice to choose a different provider of a money transfer service or something like that. They're stuck with one provider, and maybe the correctional facility only can really choose from a couple of companies anyway. So this is a space where we as advocates in this space would encourage the Biden administration to really think about industries where just addressing the problem of hidden fees isn't going to go far enough, and you have to think about whether certain kinds of fees are actually excessive, and that's the real problem. States have a role to play in this as well. States can think about how to address these fees, too.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to say that I think it's about time that there is some oversight with these financial institutions to charge whatever they feel like charging, and there's no one looking over them and monitoring them. And I think it's about time that we have a government that does step up for the consumer instead of letting these companies just go free reign.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Ariel.
Yeah, I think Daryl put it really, really well. And I think that it's a really good sign that the Biden administration is seemingly really committed to tackling this, both with its new strike force and, the FTC proposed rule is a big way that we'll hopefully get some more oversight and, actual relief for consumers who are just paying exorbitant amounts for basically everything we can think of right now.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Dennis in Two Rivers, who says when he decides what products to get, there's often terms and conditions. Are fees ever hidden there? In that fine print, often multi-page terms and conditions, Ariel, is that where the information might be about those potential hidden fees?
Definitely could be there. And I think that the Biden administration and particularly the Federal Trade Commission, as they do their rule, need to think about that exact problem. And they have proposed this rule whereby businesses have to disclose the fees, and it needs to be in a way that people can understand. You still have a hidden fees problem if it's just hidden in fine print. And so they have a real opportunity to require something like itemization of fees and to make clear what the total price is and what the breakdown of fees is. This is something that happens in the rental housing context too. Maybe you've experienced where you go to sign your lease and suddenly you see dozens of pages of addendums and they list all these other charges, and it's really hard to then understand what the total cost of your rent is, and maybe it's more than you budgeted for, and that's where those addendums and the fine print really, really hurts people.
Let's go back to our callers. Chris is with us in Oshkosh. Chris, hi.
Hi there. So I own a small business and I got a merchant account through a CRM that I was using, and they recommended this company. It was called WorldPay, or Vantiv, then WorldPay. And they would sign it, have you sign a contract, and I did not charge much on the merchant account. And that's the only way I caught it. Excuse me. 1 month, I charged no credit cards. And I happened to look at my you had to go online, too, and log in to see your statement and go through it. And it was kind of hard to find, actually. Mm-hmm. But they charged me $600 in fees that month, and I never charged one credit card. And when I called them, what they said is that if you don't catch the fee when they change it, it becomes part of the new contract. And I said, so what you're telling me is that there's nothing I can do. You're going to do whatever you want and screw me as bad as you want.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. So this sounds like a credit card processor. So small businesses like Chris's might be subjected to some of these hidden $600. That's a pretty substantial hidden fee, Ariel.
That is substantial and just shows, you know, how difficult it can be to figure out what's going on and to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, one thing I would suggest to folks is it's important to let these agencies know what's going on. Tell the FTC, you know, you could also tell the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that you're allowed to submit complaints to them. And I would also say let your state attorney general know, too. It can be a way to for them to spot these big problems and to help do something.
Chris, thanks for the call. Scott joins us now, truck driver on the road. Scott, hi. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just in prison for 9 years. And if you want to buy one of them little ramen noodle soups, you're going to pay at least like $2 almost for it nowadays. So, yeah, something that you pay a quarter or something for on the streets is like $2 or $3 in prison. To get a TV set, it's $300 for a TV set, but you can go to the store and buy the same one for $25. It is such a ripoff. There's only two catalogs that you can order out of, and they're competitive with each other. But the awesomes all charge the same price.
Scott, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. Ariel, as you were mentioning earlier, this is a vulnerable population that doesn't have a lot of options of where to shop.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing your story, Scott. And I also want to point out that I don't know if this is Scott's situation, but it's possible that a loved one who was on the outside, was not incarcerated, sent money to help the person buy the product from the commissary, the noodle soup, and that they were charged fees to do that every time they wanted to give money. So there's also fee, there's not just the markups that Scott was talking about, but also these fees taken out at the front end as well. So your money doesn't go as far in that way either.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Ariel, are you seeing momentum building to change some of these things, maybe even bipartisan support with people concerned about various kinds of hidden fees?
I definitely think there is a lot of momentum. I think that it's really helpful that the Biden administration has put a name to so many of these practices that we're seeing. And I hope that we see continued movement at the state level as well. And I'd like to think it should be bipartisan because these are issues that affect all of us. And they do also, some of them affect vulnerable folks in particular, whether you're lower income and, you know, whether you're an incarcerated or a formerly incarcerated person. And so I think this is a good moment for us to take action together.
Ariel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Ariel Nelson is a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. We talked to her about hidden fees in a variety of products and services, how they affect consumers, and the Biden administration's effort to tackle those, either limit them, get rid of them, or in some cases require disclosure of those fees in the upfront price. Still time for you to share your experiences. You could email ideas@WPR.org. Is there a hidden or unexpected fee you've encountered here in Wisconsin that you think, hey, somebody needs to look into that? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you want to meet people you have something in common with, there's a great opportunity coming up this month if your name is Ryan. The organization called the Ryan Meetup holds its next gathering in just 10 days in Chicago, pretty close by. The group invites all Ryans from around the world to get together to explore, I guess, Ryan-related interests. Last month, they held a Ryan Rodeo in Texas. You have questions, they have answers from their website. Why are you doing this? Because we want to meet other people named Ryan. Can I join if my last name is Ryan? Only if your first name is also Ryan. Can I join if my middle name is Ryan? Yes, but you'll be asked to provide references that prove you go by Ryan. Who founded the group? Ryan. That's all verbatim from their website. They're also very clear that Brian, with a B, not acceptable. But alternate spellings of Ryan, those are welcome. It's news you can use, Ryan. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Harry Enten is back with us for a look at the state of the 2024 presidential race and how to make sense of the polls after polls we'll be seeing in the months to come. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about someone reaching for their goals.
Earning a master's degree and launching a business is no easy feat. WPR's Margaret Faust met Jordan Schrader of Grafton to see how he did it while also living with a rare genetic neuromuscular disease.
I turn voice control on.
Hey Siri, open my queue, show grid, click 18. Taking a walk is like my prayer walk. I go out and talk to God, and this is when I usually really have my seclusion time with the Lord.
This is Jordan Schrader. The 30-year-old rides his wheelchair down the block in his neighborhood on a brisk afternoon. He has type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, a genetic disorder where muscles don't respond to signals from motor neurons. The muscles gradually weaken and shrink from inactivity. Schrader says growing up, he felt like he was missing out on things like sports and dancing with girls.
When you're sitting down and you can't barely move, you feel trapped, like you're always watching and spectating. You feel like you're never really, like, actively participating.
Gradually, he lost voluntary movement in his limbs. Only slight movements remain. He uses a motorized wheelchair to get around.
I'm praying and praying for these things, but none of the things I wanted at the time I thought were being answered. They were being answered, but in different ways I did not yet understand.
Schrader was born and raised Pentecostal Christian. He went to church every Sunday, and he thought he'd make a full-time career out of it.
I went to school for 8 years and all that. I got my master's in divinity. Yeah, I got ordained, but I never yet found my church staff position because I don't think the church in general is ready yet for disabled pastors.
In 2020, at the age of 27, Schrader says he hit rock bottom and went to a dark place. But then he asked himself,
what do I have left? Literally my voice. I went, okay, I can speak.
This was a turning point for Schrader. So he harnessed the power of his voice. Eventually, he delivered a TEDx talk about being a person with a disability. He felt inspired to start a motivational speaking business. His elevator pitch?
Tony Robbins, but crippled. Like, I want to help people, like, get up and walk into their destiny that God has planned for them. They just don't know it yet.
He also hosts a podcast called Handy Schlapped, where he talks about everything from disabilities to pop culture.
What is up, everyone? It is so good to be with you finally. What a crazy year.
He's also written and directed a number of short films. Rose of Sharon, his most recent work, is about a newly widowed mother who must cope with being the sole caregiver of her disabled teenage son. It won 2 awards in Green Bay. Through all of his media, he hopes to lift others up.
A bad day doesn't equal a bad life. You know, you have a choice, and it doesn't matter the circumstance. It's how you respond to the circumstances. It's not exactly a new idea, but everyone for the rest of mankind is going to need that reminder and that motivation.
And when he's not creating media, he loves to play video games in his downtime.
Fallout, Dead Space, BioShock is one of my all-time favorite games. Then I'll be like, Alexa, turn on the TV. Alexa, go to HDMI 3. And just like that, it'll start.
As he looks ahead to this next stage of life, Schrader says he wants to focus on his talents and help others take hold of their potential.
WPR's Margaret Faust brought us that story on Jordan Schrader of Grafton. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. The election this November will be the first time a current president faces a rematch with the previous president in over a century. Last time it happened was 1892 when incumbent Benjamin Harrison lost to his challenger and predecessor, Grover Cleveland. According to a lot of recent polls, President Biden has ground to make up against former President Trump. But how much can horse race polling actually tell us about voters' feelings and the eventual outcome of the race? Harry Enten is back with us to help sort things out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about polls and how to read them and what we do with them? How do you feel about a Biden-Trump rematch? Are you excited about one or the other, both somehow, or neither? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Harry Enten is a senior political data reporter and the host of CNN's Margins of Error podcast, where he specializes in data-driven journalism. Harry, welcome back to the show.
You know, it's been so long since I've been back, and also so long since I first started appearing in the show. I remember I used to call in. Now we do Google Meets, the whole technology. I feel so old.
Yeah, well, and fancy stuff now. And Harry, I remember last time we talked to you, I think it was March of 1892. Take us back to the polling.
I don't think they had any polling there. If they did it, it was literally they drop it off. You know, there would be someone who'd go house to house and kind of ask you. Today we have the internet. They would never have thought of the internet back over a century ago.
All right. Now, before we start to dig into the current state of polls, Harry, it's March, the election's in November. What do we do? What can we make of polls as we read? And we're going to read about them. We're going to hear about them in the months to come. How do you suggest people handle and process that information they're seeing about presidential polling this far out?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was, in fact, just in a spreadsheet earlier today calculating the difference between what the polls say at this point and the eventual outcome. And on average, since 1972, the difference has been about 7 points between the polls at this point and the actual outcome. And at this point, even though Donald Trump holds a minor, small lead over Joe Biden in the national polls, it's not anywhere close to approaching 7 points at this point. So I think the best way you can sort of judge the polls right now is the race looks very different than it did 4 years ago at this point when Joe Biden had a clear advantage, high single digits. Right now, however, it's a race that, in my opinion, at least when it comes to the national popular vote, it's a race that simply put is too close to call. And I'm not really quite sure it's going to shift from that. And that's going to, at this point, you know, if you're looking at 1, 2, 3 point leads, even all the way down the stretch of the campaign on election day, one candidate may be slightly favored, but it's a race truly that anyone could win.
And as you used to point out when you were on with us pretty regularly, Harry, there is no national election. It's state. It's a whole bunch of state elections, and we sort of add them all up together. How much harder can it be to call, battleground states like Wisconsin that really can be a coin toss almost? We're so close sometimes.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, if you look right now of the states, you know, these key battleground states, you know, if you just look at the 6 closest states that Joe Biden won in 2020, he probably needs to win at least 3 of those in order to stay in the White House. Wisconsin's one of the closest out of all of them, right? You know, you'll see a poll that might have Donald Trump up by a point, but then you'll see one that has Joe Biden up a point or two. The real issue, you know, when you're sort of compiling up all the swing state polling is, one, there's less of it than there is nationally. And two, trying to figure out the relationship between the different swing states. Right. So let's say if the polls are off by a point or two in Arizona, and let's say the polls are off by a point or two and they have Donald Trump too far ahead, does that mean that the same is going to hold in Wisconsin, or the polls going to have Donald Trump up 1 or 2 points more than he actually better than he does on election day. We're not necessarily sure about that. So when you're looking at the Electoral College and you're looking at the battleground states, it's just even you have to give yourself even a wider margin of error. One other quick thing I will note is that in the last two elections, the national popular vote has tended to underestimate how well Donald Trump would do in the swing states, right? You know, you take a state like Wisconsin, where Biden won it by less than a point in 2020. Nationally, he won by about 4.5 points. So I think when there are a lot of folks like myself looking at these national polls showing Donald Trump up by a point or two, we say if that previous pattern between the swing states and the national vote holds, then maybe Donald Trump is actually in a stronger position than we think. But the honest to God's truth is we just don't know at this particular point.
A question coming out of 2016, Harry, and correct me if I'm wrong. There was a, you know, there was margin of error. There's a question in each individual state. Is it going to be more toward Trump, more toward Hillary Clinton than we expect? And what ended up happening was many states, key states, battleground states, swung more toward Trump at the same time. Are pollsters trying to do something to compensate for that so that their overall prediction is a little more reliable?
You know, the question is, what aren't they trying to do? That, I think, is the real thing. They're putting everything up against the wall. You know, things that they might do differently than they did previous is, you know, going back 8-12 years down the road, as they're making sure they weight by education, right? Because we know that Donald Trump's core group of voters are voters without a college degree. They are waiting. A lot of pollsters are now waiting on the past presidential vote. So they'll say, okay, who'd you vote for in 2020? And then they'll try and line it up with how things necessarily went. They're even waiting by such things as volunteering status. The idea essentially being that if you volunteer, you're actually more likely to answer a poll than those who don't volunteer. Kind of makes some sense, right? So they're trying to match that up with what we know nationally about how many Americans volunteer in their community and not. So they're really doing a whole slew of things. The question ultimately is whether it works. I don't know the answer to that. But the one thing I will say is it's quite possible that the polls actually underestimate Joe Biden this time around. They may not just underestimate Donald Trump, or of course, the polls could be right on accurate. We'll just have to wait and see.
Harry Enten is with us, senior political data reporter, host of CNN's Margins of Error podcast. We're talking about the latest polling on the presidential election and what we do with that polling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your biggest concerns as you look at this presidential campaign? Would anything convince you to vote for Biden over Trump or vice versa? Do you see yourself as being on the fence in some way? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions about polling. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Harry Enten, CNN senior political data reporter, looking at a Biden-Trump rematch and what we can and can't take away from the polls this far out. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your hopes, your fears for this presidential campaign, your questions or opinions about polling itself. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Maggie is with us in Woodbury, Minnesota. Maggie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Maggie?
I am 100% behind Biden. He brought us through the pandemic. He did not abandon the states like Trump did. He used federal agencies to help in any way possible. They cleared it for pharmacists and others to do the vaccine, so rural people had greater access. And he has brought the economy back. We didn't hit the soft recession. Maybe we still will, but the stock market is at historic highs. We have low unemployment. We have lower inflation than other countries, the European Union and those countries.
Maggie, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Harry, Maggie takes us into issues that people will vote on and who they trust more on issues. What kind of things are you seeing?
You know, it's so interesting. I hear from Biden supporters all the time talking about what they believe is a strong economy. And obviously, if you look at the stock market, if you look at the job situation, I think it's tough to argue otherwise, right? But if you ask Americans who they trust more on the economy, They trust Donald Trump more on the economy than Joe Biden. They believe that inflation, that things are significantly higher than they want them to be. And I think that in the voters' minds, they are looking back to 4-5 years ago, while the Biden campaign will argue, as your caller just did, that inflation has been far worse in other countries and that it's been getting better. But voters right now aren't making that connection. At this particular point, if this campaign rests on how folks feel about the economy, it's a good story for Donald Trump. Will that be the case a little less than 8 months from now? Maybe if consumer sentiment continues to rise, maybe as inflation perhaps continues to come down, we'll have to wait and see. But at this point, the economy is not the issue that Joe Biden wants this election to be decided on. Otherwise, Donald Trump is most likely going to win.
Maggie, thanks for the call. Mark joins us now in Sun Prairie. Mark, hi.
Oh, hi. Hey, Harry, quick question for you. So in the way you do your polling, how do you account for the situation where people really aren't favoring one or another? They're just sending a message. They're just grumpy about what's going on, and they want to send a message to the current president that, hey, do something better. And so we are going to say we're not going to vote for you.
Mark, thanks for the call. Harry.
You know, I walk around the newsroom sometimes and I say, I wonder if the voters are just LARPing it. That is live action role playing and essentially being, I am not going to vote for Biden because I want to send him a message exactly as your caller just said. But at the end of the day, this is why the polls, we say, you know, the polls measure attitudes right now. There's no guarantee that what voters say right now is going to be what holds in a little more than 7 months or a little less than 8 months down the line. For most voters, it's going to be, you know, they say Biden, they're going to vote Biden. They say Trump, they're going to vote Trump. But it's really that 10% in the middle who we really are not sure about. And to be honest, aren't really paying very close attention to the race right now. They're more concerned about putting food on the table or picking their kids up from school. So polls are capturing voter attitudes at this place and time. Where they are 7.5-8 months down the line, that's why we have a campaign in which both of the candidates are going to go out and try and get people's votes.
Thanks for that call. Before I go back to our callers, Harry, something from the primary I wanted to ask you about. I was on the Nikki Haley campaign mailing list here at work. They sent lots and lots of polls, including some here in Wisconsin, showing in head-to-heads, Haley beats Biden by pretty substantial measures in those polls, much more neck and neck races between Trump and Biden. What do you make of that? The thought that potentially Haley might have been a better head-to-head competitor against Biden, but had really no shot, it turned out, to win the Republican nomination.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it before, right? It wouldn't be too much of a surprise. Haley's favorable ratings among moderates and independents is significantly higher than Donald Trump's were. So it is quite plausible in that, you know, universe that obviously we don't exist in, that Nikki Haley could have beaten Joe Biden, and it would have been a significantly wider margin for her than if Donald Trump ends up beating Joe Biden. But the fact is that at this particular point, even if that may be the case, Donald Trump still has a pretty gosh darn good shot of beating Joe Biden. And you know, ultimately, we play the race that we play, and it's not just about winning the general election. You have to get past the primary as well. And Nikki Haley, for all her good polling in the general election, simply put, couldn't sell it in a primary.
Back to our callers now as we talk to Harry Enten about the presidential campaign, polling therein. Tim is with us in Red Wing, Minnesota. Tim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, my wife and I are both educators, and I'm a veteran of U.S. military service, and we would 100% vote for Joe Biden again. We plan to, and we hope the rest of the country does as well.
And do you have particular concerns about Donald Trump as a candidate, or would you just generally vote for a Democratic candidate?
No, I'd always I voted for either party before, but I would never vote for a narcissist who wants to end democracy. I like to vote.
Tim, thanks for the call. And Harry, there's this ongoing question. Is there something special about Donald Trump? Tim points out his concerns about a second Trump presidency. Is he somehow different in how polling works around him and how elections work around him?
So I think there are a few questions in there. First off, you know, if you ask voters what's their most important issue, and if they say defending democracy, That's probably a ground that Joe Biden, at least according to the polling, would much rather play on than the economy. So I think that's one thing. Two, I think there's the question of, and you kind of brought it up before, would a different Republican do better against Joe Biden than Donald Trump is? Maybe, but I will point out that for the most part, when you ask, you know, a generic ballot question, that is an unnamed Democrat against an unnamed Republican, the Biden-Trump polls right now pretty closely mirror that. So I'm not 100% sure that if Donald Trump weren't on the ballot, that Republicans would necessarily be doing better, although I think there's a pretty good case to be made for that. And as for the idea, you know, that it's more difficult to measure support when Trump is on the ballot, maybe so. But, you know, we've only had two general elections with Donald Trump actually on the ballot. And while in both of those cases, the polls did underestimate his standing versus the final result, there's no guarantee that that will be the case this go around.
And Harry, let's ask a fundamental question here. Given that, polls today don't predict an outcome and that it may be hard to discern what they're going to mean, why do polls? Why pay attention to polls? Why report on polls?
Well, I think part of it is because it's just gosh darn fun, at least for me. We're having this conversation. But more than that, I think it's important because, yes, we're talking about the horse race. But I think, you know, we've sort of hinted at in the last few questions, we find out more about the voters than just who they're going to vote for. We find out why they're going to vote for these candidates. We find out what issues are important to Americans. I think that's very important, especially as politicians try and claim what Americans want. We can actually ask polls, do stuff like focus groups as well, and find out for real what they want. And more than that, you know, in this era in which some candidates, including Donald Trump, wanted to claim that the 2020 election was in fact stolen from him, despite the fact that there's no real evidence of that being the case, I think polling and showing that the results came either A, pretty close to the polling, or B, Trump actually did better than the polls, would suggest that in fact, the elections that we hold are legitimate. So there's, you know, there are a bunch of different reasons, but I think part of it is fun, but part of it, as I mentioned, there is far more serious. And I think we, not surprisingly, should continue to do polling even this far out.
Harry, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
My friend, it's always a pleasure. I hope to be back soon.
Excellent. Harry Enten is a senior political data reporter and the host of CNN's Margins of Error podcast. He talked to us today about what polls can and can't tell us about the upcoming presidential election. Just 8 months away, you know. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a bill in Congress would force the sale of the social media giant TikTok to new owners or block it in the United States if that sale isn't made. We'll check out the legislation and what's behind it. You can get that conversation started right now. Do you or does someone in your family use TikTok a lot? What do you think of this idea of forcing a sale or banning it? Do you have concerns about national security related to TikTok, which is what's driving this whole effort? Email ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, ultra-processed food is getting a lot of criticism and health warnings lately. What is it? How much should we worry? A Wisconsin nutrition expert joins us for a look at the latest research on food and health. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.